Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Our program today is a celebration of Tlingit language and culture, but not in the traditional sense, but in the fusion of Tlingit culture and language in modern storytelling and music. And one example is known to children all across America.
Hey, everyone, it's me, Molly.
Molly, up the Nolly.
Let's go.
She's Molly, up the Nolly.
Recognize her bubbly voice there? Well, a number of the episodes for her show have been written by Tlingit writers, three artists who have been at the heart of this renaissance of Tlingit language and culture in Southeast Alaska, and they join us now. We have with us today Lance Hune Twitchell, Vera Setque Starbard, and Frank Kosh Katas. Maybe we'll start with Lance. What has it been like to be a part of this amazing project?
Thanks for having us here. It's been fabulous. So I was brought on initially as a culture and language consultant and got to see some early versions of some of the shows that were coming out, the pilots and stuff, and it was just mind-blowing to see and to have a Native American child be a main character in a show. So it's been just amazing to be a part of and to witness.
So Lance, just very quickly though, your episode that you wrote aired this week. Were you surprised that it aired this particular week?
It was interesting to see the process of when episodes are coming out and to finally see it, because I had seen it. I had shown it to my kids because we had seen the near final version of it. And so to see the final version and to just sort of say, oh, it was just amazing. That's all.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to go to Vera Starbard here. Vera, you've been working on this project a little while longer and have a number of episodes. What has this been like for you?
I know it's cliche. I probably said it 1,000 times. It's genuinely an honor, like, to be able to be any part of ushering this sort of what will become very iconic show into the world has been pretty amazing. The just care that they've taken with ensuring that there's authentic Alaska Native voices represented in the show is actually can be really emotional because it's so beautiful to see, but also just exciting and really exciting the more people see it.
You know, in getting ready for this show, I kind of choked up a bit as I watched some of the episodes that you pointed me to. Even though Molly is so joyful, I don't know why, but I did get emotional watching those because I guess it was beautiful to see Native culture celebrated in this way. Now, Frank Katas, who is with us, also wrote an episode, and it really wasn't even about Tlingit culture. It involves an Athabascan family, an interior Athabascan family. What has that been like to be writing a script for a story about another Native culture?
It's about approaching it, delicately, because you're writing about a different culture and to sort of trust in what our process is. One great thing about this show is that Molly Denali takes the time to make sure that the representation that's on screen is authentic. And by doing that, they have cultural advisors come in and help sort of guide what this story could be. You know, at the beginning, we're pitching just like broad stroke ideas, and then we use with the guidance of the writers, the writer's room, and the cultural advisors, we sort of mold what the story could be and making sure that it has an authentic voice and that what's up on screen is a good representation of the people up north.
Let's start with your episode, Frank, even though it kind of is designed to air around the holidays. Maybe you could set this episode for us up. It's kind of a play on the word holiday, a holy day sweater.
Right. Holiday sweater. Yeah, it's about It's sort of like what Hune was saying just a minute ago. It's something you write 3 years ago, and then it suddenly it pops up, and you're like, oh, yeah. You know, because the process of animation is you know, time-consuming, and to make sure that you're doing it right and authentic is really important. But, yeah, the episode is about this family sweater that has been passed down that a grandma has made, and it gets a hole torn in it, and they can't figure out. They're worried about the grandma being sad or upset about the hole in the sweater. So they decide they're going to go fix it by, you know, finding the yarn. Turns out it's Kvyat from Muskox. And then they have to spin the wool, and the grandma helps them, shows up, sees the hole, helps them with the sweater. So it was a really fun episode to write and imagine. And sort of I learned about Kvyat. Maybe more information than I'll ever want to know about Kvyat.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen any musk oxen or in these parts. But anyway, let's listen to a little bit of the soundtrack from the episode. And it begins when Molly's friend Tui is lamenting the fact that he's going to have to wear this Christmas sweater. That was before the hole was torn into it.
Of all the holiday traditions, my favorite one is Tui's holiday sweater.
Happy holidays, Molly.
Happy holidays. Wait a second. Why are you so happy? I thought you didn't like wearing that sweater.
I don't, but look. It's too short. The sleeves, too.
Yeah!
The less you're in the sweater, the less you're in the sweater. No, Luca, the sweater is not for pups. I can't believe how long it's been around. My grandma Elizabeth made this sweater for my oldest brother, Jay. And then when Jay outgrew it, my other brother, John, had to wear it. Then when John couldn't fit in it anymore, it was my turn. The only way to get out of wearing this sweater is if you outgrow it. So, the less you're in the sweater, the less you're in the sweater. Luca, no! Down!
Oh, no!
What?
Grandma's sweater!
She'll be so upset. This sweater is supposed to go to my little cousin Benji next. Now the Christmas tradition is ruined.
And as it turns out, it was Sivu the husky that bit a hole in the sweater. But I guess the sweater got fixed. And then what was the upshot at the very end, Frank?
They had... Oh, I don't want to give away all of the ending, but yeah, let's just say the sweater gets fixed somehow. But yeah, I love hearing that because my grandma's name was Elizabeth, so I wrote that in. I have a brother named John and a brother named Jay, and my dog's name was Benji.
So did
I find
you,
ways to implement them in?
How did you get the idea about the holiday sweater? Is that something that's in your family?
No, actually, I think the original idea was it was a Chilcat blanket that had gotten torn, but we realized they probably didn't have access to the materials up there, so they couldn't just go and get some John Woo wool, some mountain goat wool. So I think it within the writing room and the discussion with some of the cultural advisors, and it sort of turned into a holiday sweater, which once I figured out what Kvyat was, it's really, really expensive yarn. So I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So we kind of ran with that.
You know, I don't really want to give away the story, but it's kind of neat that the process of repairing that sweater involves a lot. What did you think about writing all those things that they had to do to fix the sweater?
I learned a lot about how to spin yarn and going through, and the initial processes and of writing it was very long and a little bit dry. So we had to sort of figure out how to punch it up and make it a little bit more exciting. But yeah, it was a lot of information. It's not an easy task.
Well, I wonder. I haven't watched all of the episodes, but I wonder if that dog, Sivu, is the nexus for so much trouble. Because, Vera, your story that you wrote, one of them, Navagi, involves Sivu up to no good. Apparently he, again, is the source of the problem. Will you set this up for us?
Well, this one actually features Suki, Molly's dog, Molly's husky, who definitely features in a lot of the episodes because huskies in general have so much energy and so much troublemaking potential. And this episode, Ninavagi, Molly finally gets the opportunity to make Grandpa's famous Navagi, which is like Yupik ice cream, or there's a lot of different gudeg. And Suki eats the finished product. So Molly has to figure out how to get the ingredients back to make this sort of award-winning Navagi.
Well, let's take a listen to this. Here we go.
You're gonna need snacks.
How about I take one piece of dry fish for the trip and another for my belly? And now, I have another favor to ask. You know the annual Kaya ice cream competition?
Of course! You've won 5 years straight. You're an ice cream legend.
The problem is I can't enter this year. I'll be away. Unless... would you enter for me?
Yes! Of course! 1,000%!
I knew I could count on you. Follow me. The contest is tomorrow, Molly. You'll want to get started early. These are the ingredients. And here is my top secret recipe.
Don't worry. I won't let you down. Starting now. Welcome to the Athabascan Chef. Today I'm making Grandpa Nat's Navagi, an Alaskan native ice cream. It's different than other kinds of ice cream. There's no ice and no cream, but there is mousse. Ingredients: 2 cups mousse fat, 1 cup dried mousse meat, 1 cup wild strawberries, and 1/2 cup mashed wild carrot. Step 1. Whip fat until fluffy. When I'm done whipping, it'll look like cake frosting. Keep whipping. Nearly there. Almost. Oh. Woo! That's what it looks like when you're done. What do you think, Suki? Let's see. Step 2. Mix in dried mousse meat. Step 3. Fold in wild strawberries. Step 4. Add mashed wild carrots to taste. Not quite like Grandpa's. Not bad. Molly, where are you? Upstairs, Tui.
And of course, that's when Suki makes his move. So did you decide to do that, or was that something that the crew wanted you to put into the script?
The original idea was actually fry bread, and then the group, the sort of writing room, came up with a gudeg. Actually, one of the cultural advisors came up with a gudeg as maybe a little bit more healthy than fry bread, because I make fry bread, but I've never made a gudeg before.
Well, of course, a lot of people put different things in a gudeg. At least I've never had it with moose fat. Usually, seal oil, maybe, or even yeah. Crisco.
I'd actually never had one from the interior. I'd only had a gudeg from like coastal areas, so it was pretty cool finding out. I knew there were a ton of recipes for a gudeg, different Navagi, but I had no idea actually when I actually started researching truly how many recipes there were for this dish.
So Lance, were you surprised at kind of working with the crew, consulting with them on story ideas and the process? How did that work for you?
Yeah, it's incredible to work with the team that's on Molly of Denali. And so there's a bit of a negotiation here because there's no single Alaska Native culture. So we have a team of Alaska Native writers, and we're writing more and more of the episodes, which is exciting. And I think the goal is to continue in that direction so that there's accurate representation as much as possible, both in terms of just living in Alaska and also being Alaska Native. But then there's a bit of a back and forth because it has to be something that kids everywhere can relate to. And so one of the challenges is to make sure that we have something that's authentic and that's not being, it's got to squeeze through this lens of PBS. And that means like the stories we tell to some of our kids, I think Big Bird might frown upon some of these stories. But just sort of thinking of the process, like there's a whole team that gives you feedback. And a lot of that feedback, it's a really fascinating process as a writer to come up with this idea and then to have that idea continue to sort of push forward through a series of conversations and then have the writing. And then, you know, and sometimes it's a little tense because they might say, well, kids in Boston might not know what pilot bread is. And then I'm like, well, I'm going to fight for pilot bread. But it's fun because we can advocate with each other. There's a team, and Princess Johnson was the creative producer for the first two seasons. And she was just wonderful to work with, just in terms of making sure, like even as a writer, sometimes like I would put something in there that I think is funny. But then it turns out it's actually going against cultural values because they're making fun of food or they're doing something. And so it's a fun process. And I would say when the program first launched, I was teaching a group of students in Sitka, and there were high school students that were juniors and seniors, what they call rising juniors, rising seniors. And so some of them were getting ready to go to college, and we were preparing them for a college experience. And this one student, so Molly comes out and they drop like 16 episodes or so, and they're on YouTube, and he didn't come to class the next day. And then I saw him that evening. I was like, hey, what's going on? He said, well, Molly of Denali came out, and I watched them all. Then by the time I went to sleep, it was too late and I couldn't wake up in time. And so I was like, well, I'm not encouraging you to miss class, but that's a pretty good reason to not. Just to see, because this is an Alaska Native student who was struggling with the college experience. And then just to see how much he loved that show. And then as we watch it together as a group, when the show was debuting, just to see him so excited in a chair. And this is a 17-year-old young man. And just to see how captivating it was to see an Alaska Native main character in a PBS TV show. And then to look at my kids who were there, and I was emotional about the whole thing. I was crying in front of everybody, just trying to explain. Like when I was a kid, we didn't have representation. We were the ones that Bugs Bunny's shooting and making jokes about. And the representation was horrible for Native American peoples. And then to see a capable, intelligent, smart, funny Molly and a cast of characters that are also diverse has just been fabulous.
Well, Frank, how about for you? What has this experience been like as far as realizing that this content is truly authentic? Because I'm thinking about shows that I've seen about Alaska, Northern Exposure. Do you all remember that one? I think, you know, where they would go halfway across the state in a 20-minute flight or something.
My dad was an extra on that.
Seriously, what part did he play?
He was just a background actor because they shot it in Cle Elum, I think, Washington, and we lived like 10 minutes away while my mom was getting her master's degree. But yeah, no, I think the representation absolutely matters. I mean, it sort of reminds me, in my play, They Don't Talk Back, I talk about one of the characters latching on to the Ultimate Warrior because he was convinced he was an indigenous warrior and he was fighting Hulk Hogan and all this other stuff. But it turns out that Ultimate Warrior was an Italian guy from Jersey. But the representation there, I think the metaphor still stands. You're grasping at straws to find representation, just like Hune was saying, and to see someone, you know, I have a young daughter, and having her look up to Molly is really something special. When we were little, that nothing like that existed. Absolutely. I mean, we were, like I said, looking for anything, Ultimate Warrior, or I think there was a show called Lone Star or something like that. That was a cartoon about an indigenous man. So, you know, just trying to find anything and seeing Molly and Denali and tackling authentic stories is truly magical. And I think that really has an effect on children that are watching it, going, wow, there I am, or there's my friend, or they're talking about something that I know and relate to. And that gives a sense of pride. And I think that's super, super important. And having the team, cultural advisors like Hune, having someone like Vera helping us guide these stories, or having Sydney Isaac in, I think, Washington, D.C. to help guide these stories as well, is super important. She called me the other day and goes, in one of your scripts, is it Je or is it Je? And I go, I think it's Je. She's like, great. She's in Boston. Thank you. But yeah, so having that makes sense. She's in Boston. But having that attention to detail is bringing an authentic show to the masses, and people are responding to it in very positive ways. I mean, this won the Peabody last year. It had, 36 million individual viewers or something. People are tuning in to see authentic Alaskan voices. Some of that might have been glossed over, or they weren't, you know, the center of the stories for things like Northern Exposures.
Well, that is really funny that a family member actually was an extra in that. This would be a good time to go to Lance's story, which aired this week, about funny faces, because it speaks to the authenticity involved in portraying Native Americans, because it's usually not there. Lance, you want to set this up for us?
Yeah, sure. This was a really fun episode to write. So initially, it was starting with just this sort of idea of someone photographing Native peoples long time ago, and just these sort of stories that kind of filter around about what some of these photography things were like. And there's some legends out there about, like, always having them wear regalia and not allowing people to smile. And then when you see some of these old photos and you try and sort of think about that kind of stuff, because I was in Sitka a couple years ago teaching Tlingit, and someone came up to me and said, to be fair, I think she had lost some of her social filters due to maybe some onset dementia, but she said, well, I didn't think Tlingits laughed. And so I said to her, I was like, well, it might not be funny when everybody's taken everything that belongs to you and is sacred, but we're still over here telling jokes. But it just sort of makes me think about some stuff like representation. And so it kind of started from that perspective. And then I had some ideas in there. And I was in a play years ago. It was a Tlingit version of Macbeth. And the cast had this game that we learned from an Inupiaq actor called Muk, where somebody says Muk, and now you've got to stare at each other without smiling. The first one to smile loses. And so I initially had that in there, and then Princess had talked about funny face competitions, and then it just sort of developed into this idea from there. And then just trying to think of how to utilize these characters and utilize humor, and also the perception that people don't laugh or don't smile when actually you just might not know them very well. And so that was the sort of the birthplace of the story.
Well, the story begins with a book that's not quite so authentic. You want to explain, and then we'll play it.
Yeah, so they're in the library, and they see a book called People of the Rivers. And then as they look at it, they're sort of learning about captions. So as a writer on this series, you have to put some teaching elements in there. There's these certain types of teaching elements that we're given to sort of select from and to work into an episode. And so one of them is a lot about, like, interpreting a text. And so looking at it and saying, well, this isn't right. And I think that's really important, like, as an Indigenous person to know and to teach our kids, like, it might be about us, but it wasn't with us. And so we like to say nothing about us without us. And so along those lines, they see this book and they say, Oh, well, how come they're wearing regalia when they're cleaning fish? And then when they go to their auntie, that they were told not to smile, and they were told to wear their regalia, even though you wouldn't wear it for cleaning fish. They learn about a funny face competition, and that one of the people photoed in there was like one of the champions. And so they end up bringing back this tradition. And then Myrna comes, and it kind of goes from there.
All righty, well, let's listen.
People of the Rivers?
Yeah, that's an old book about the tribes who live along the rivers.
Ooh, what's going on in this picture?
Why don't you read the caption? Captions give more information about pictures and photos.
The caption says, "Mushers play an important role in transporting goods through the community." Pictured here, Tim Hawk, musher, age 46. Who feeds their dogs in dance regalia?
It's like farming in your fancy clothes.
She's wearing regalia to clean fish?
Who wants fish slime on moose hide?
Maybe the caption will tell us. Fish are an important staple of the Alaskan diet. Families go to fish camps each summer. Pictured here, Sarah Johnson, age 25. Huh, nothing about why she's dressed up or looks so grumpy.
Everyone I know is happy at fish camp.
Well, no one's happy in here.
How can you call your book People of the Rivers if it doesn't look anything like the people of the rivers?
It isn't very accurate, but Auntie Midge is in here somewhere.
What? Where?
There she is.
So what did we learn from Auntie Midge about why everybody is frowning, Kune?
So what we learned was there was a photographer who came, and then he didn't want people to smile when he took their picture. And so a lot of this, I think, is just coming at humor is such a central part of a lot of Alaska Native cultures, and especially the ways that we bond with each other and we interact with each other. And a lot of folks in the episode are intimidated by Aunt Myrna, you know. So like I've had relatives of mine where people come up and say, "Oh, geez, she always looks so grumpy." I was like, "What are you talking about? She's so fun and funny." But I think there's this cultural divide that's there. And then the kids say, "Well, we could do our own book, and we could do a book that's accurate about who we are."
That is very lovely. One of the experiences that Vera and I shared not too long ago, and I'd just like to talk a little bit about it here, is a friend of mine's daughter loves Molly of Denali, watches it, and she really loved the episode about herring eggs. That it was one of Molly's favorite foods. It comes from Southeast, and she really wanted to try it. And did I know anybody who could give her an opportunity to try herring eggs? So Vera, I never did find out what happened with that.
Oh my goodness, that made my day, and you better believe that I got her some herring eggs. It was absolutely like one of the most memorable experiences from this whole thing, to have a young viewer get inspired, a non-Native young viewer get inspired to want to try something that Molly's doing. And I was able to like close that circle and give her my favorite food, herring eggs, because of that. Like, it was just the absolute greatest example of what any show can do, but something that this show is doing.
All right. Well, we're going to have to take a quick little break, but don't go away.